This is New York Now.
Hello and welcome to the New York Now Convention Cast. I'm Casey Seiler, the state editor of the Times Union. I am here with Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio, and we are joined by our very first guest, appropriately enough, the chairman of the State Republican Committee, Ed Cox. Thanks very much for taking the time.
It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
Now, your first convention was 1968. There have been many lines of connection made between what the country is going through now, a time of division, polarization, and what the country was going through then. Tell us a little bit about that and what you were doing exactly at the 1968 convention in Miami, correct?
Well, I was actually there with the Nixon family. I had started going out with Tricia when she came to New York after her father lost the governorship race in California in 62. And 63, as a senior in high school, she went to my sister's high school. I met her at a class dance, and we were dating for that 5 years up to the 68 convention. So I was there with the Nixon family in the background, watching it all, talking to the future president of the United States and others. And it was a very, very exciting convention. Ours could have gone that way, and they say history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And it looked like there was a real rhyme when we had three candidates out there, one who was very conservative, such as Ronald Reagan was. He was challenging from the right. And you had Governor Rockefeller challenging from the more moderates, like Kasich was. In the middle, you had someone who had what later became called the silent majority. And of course, here was Donald Trump, and then it was Richard Nixon back then.
Did you want to be in politics originally, or did the Nixon family kind of pull you in, suddenly being in the midst of all of this?
Well, I was more an observer of politics, and I wanted to be a lawyer, and I was headed to law school, to college, and then on to law school, and worked very hard in a major Wall Street firm. But there comes a time when, over 30 years of being with President Nixon and listening to him and the imperative of doing something greater than yourself and something for your country. I worked with him a lot. I was able to do a lot through him. After he passed and Governor Pataki got elected to governor, and I was asked, because I was very much involved in that, I was asked to be a trustee of the state university. I was asked to be responsible for authorizing charter schools. I was asked to straighten out the construction fund after a big scandal. State university. I was asked to be chairman of the council, all while practicing law, which is very good. But there came a time after we lost everything in the state in 2008, including our majority in the Senate for the first time since the 30s, and that the great state of New York needed to have a really viable opposition, and I started working to do it, getting involved in elected politics as opposed to just administrative and doing things, and that led to my being chairman of the party.
You mentioned a little while ago, in 1962, of course, your future father-in-law lost the gubernatorial race in California. If anyone had said in 1962 or 1963 that Richard Nixon was going to be the presidential nominee of the Republican Party in 1968 and was going to win, I'm sure a lot of people would have said, that's crazy, that guy's done. I think Nixon himself said in his famous, final press conference, you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. Think how bad you're going to feel when you wake up tomorrow. Is that comparable to the sense of surprise that a lot of Republicans, I think, feel as they arrive in Cleveland for Donald Trump's Republican convention?
Well, Richard Nixon, at that low point in his political career, had a lot of friends who believed in him. And many of them were in New York City and said, I'll quote it, in fact, Dick, you're going to die in the vine on the West Coast. Come to New York City where the action is. Join a law firm here and we'll see what happens. So he still had a core of supporters who believed in him. Just because they knew him well, they had seen him as vice president, and by the way, it wasn't just those supporters. When he traveled around the world after that, Charles de Gaulle rarely sees many people at the time. He was president of France, Laurent Charles, wanted to see him one-on-one. Adenauer, who was just retired as chancellor, the great chancellor brought Germany back to being a democracy and a free market, the success that it is afterward, wanted to see him. These world leaders who he had met knew this was an extraordinary individual, and the sense that he could come back, and they wanted to be a part of that. And they were concerned about the way America was going back
then. In 68, he ran very much as a law and order candidate in a time of, you know, great social upheaval. That's very much what Trump is going for. We're going to hear tonight, Monday night, in prime time from Rudy Giuliani. I'm sure that's a note that's going to be played very hard by the speakers, many of the speakers.
Well, and let me go back and say this. Donald Trump has on his wall a letter from President Nixon from 1987 saying that when you run, you will win. So he... In many ways, I mean, he calls his supporters unapologetically, says, the silent majority. And in many ways, it is the core Nixon supporters. And law and order is an important part of that silent majority coalition, particularly in a time when people feel that they're not safe. And the people who, look, there are bad guys in this world, not just abroad, but here at home. And that thin blue line defends us. And when it's not supported, you hear the kind of support that people want to give them, such as Larry Kudlow evoked when he mentioned that. And when you see cops getting killed the way they have been, that the country watches that and say, no, we can't afford that. These are intentional killings. Which is very much different than the interaction between citizens.
Dallas and Baton Rouge.
Right, Dallas. Yeah. It's very much different than killings that happen, which, unfortunately, when cops whose lives are always at risk and doing their duty, and they run into citizens who are breaking the law, who may be carrying guns or otherwise, in those circumstances, things happen. And that's just part of their doing their duties, unfortunately.
When you're talking about the silent majority, I'm wondering, some of the things that Trump has said has been very controversial, not necessarily politically correct, but is he saying a lot of things that people are thinking and won't say?
People, part of the Make America Great Again is that people feel that they are, in fact, restricted in doing the things that they want to do to make their families great and prosper, to make the companies, maybe their own small enterprise that they're working for, great, to make the country great. And part of that is political correctness. Oh, you can't deal with reality. You have to say it in the right way. If you don't, look, to get things done in this world, you have to deal with the reality of the world. And political correctness, which is a restraint on language and the way you do things, I know it's very aspirational and this and that, but in the end, you got to get things done. And that's why I say he's appealing to the sergeants of the world. These are the people who get stuff done. If you're in the Army, the sergeant's pretty blunt and crude in many ways. Some are very sophisticated also. But the officers...
They're blunt, right?
Oh, they are blunt because they have to get... They are dealing with reality. Not just in training, but in war. You're dealing in battle. You're dealing with reality. And the sergeants are responsible for those troops. And it's life or death. And political correctness is not what you're thinking about. You're thinking, how do I get this thing done and protect my people and accomplish the mission? And the sergeants are the crucial links between the officers and the men who are out there on the battle line. And it's the same thing with the sergeants and the people who are trying to build their companies and trying to and they're very proud of the country. And America is disrespected abroad. They're having a harder time. And I have to say, Newt Gingrich was right on when he said the problem is not necessarily taxes now, although it is. Particularly corporate tax, the way it's structured with respect to the rest of the world, but it's regulations, smothering regulations that are coming out of this administration. He's dead right. This is Hernando de Soto. That's a little obtuse, but people have written about this. Regulations are not as obvious as taxes, but they can crush an economy, and that is a very important part of what President Trump has to do to turn the economy around this country.
The delegates heard from Newt Gingrich, of course, at the Monday breakfast, just so our podcast listeners know that.
And I wanted to ask you about something else that Gingrich spoke about in depth, which is a subject that I think a lot of people in the audience might have been surprised to hear him talk about, and that is the need for the party to be more inclusive, to do a better job of outreach to minorities, including African Americans, of course. Now, this might be a long question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. You've, of course, and everybody in the party on the national level has looked at the demographic trends that show that, you know, we're a decade or two away from white people being a minority within American society. Of course, New York Republicans have been dealing with a very large minority electorate for a long, long time. Now, I turned around and I looked out at the audience for the New York delegation, 550 members, including guests and media. It was overwhelmingly white. What was your reaction to what Gingrich was talking about? It was a theme that Larry Kudlow, one of the other speakers today, struck on as well, but he kind of hit it from the other side, as it were, saying, you know, fatherless homes have no one around to tell the kids that cops are good people, that kind of thing. It was sort of a much tougher message. I mean, how does the Republican Party build out among minorities?
Well, this is very important for New York State, obviously, and particularly New York City, which we need to do a lot better on if we're going to carry the state. I personally have been working with inner city schools since 1986. You remember the Reagan Nation at Risk, the Commission on Education that wrote that, and that inspired us to start a mentoring process. Now mentors 1,500 students, pays for them, parochial schools, inner school kids, and then charter schools. Education is the civil rights issue of our time, and we as Republicans have the high ground on that, and we're going to be using technology to, we're doing this right now as it is, and it worked here in Cleveland, and won Cleveland for Governor Kasich, and it's going to help us win the mayoralty in New York. Shh, don't tell the Democrats what we're doing, because they're ignorant about the use of big data and technology and stuff that we're going to be using to locate those people in the inner city who are for charter schools, who are for the parochial schools that were the original good schools for minorities in the inner city.
So education, schools.
Education, that's a civil rights issue of our time. And look, our roots are with Lincoln. And there are many folks like Ruby Wright, who is the oldest delegate here at the convention. She has been a Republican because we are the party of Lincoln. The civil rights laws that Johnson passed, a larger percentage of Republicans in Congress voted them for those than Democrats. They could not have been passed. You take a look at the history of what Vice President Nixon, a Quaker, Underground Railroad is part of his background, and what he did in the civil rights era as Vice President. I've had conversations, this is getting a little bit into the weeds, but with Judge Tyler, who is head of the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department, was a partner in my law firm, about everything that Vice President Nixon did quietly in the civil rights arena as vice president. You take a look at what he did with desegregating the South. I was talking to Schultz out at the services for Nancy Reagan, and he was sitting there, and because he's elderly now, I knelt down, was talking.
This is George Schultz.
Yeah. You know, he was Secretary of Labor, yeah, head of OMB under Nixon, then Secretary of Treasury, and then Secretary of State. I mean, a really great man. The first thing he talked about, Ed, what we did to desegregate the South, and this is the way we did it, from 95% segregated to being almost completely desegregated, and he did it. And I said, I know you really did that. And he had the backing of President Nixon to do it. And he said, no, I had more than that. This is Schultz talking. He was correcting him, saying, no, he was right there with me, making sure that the laws were enforced and the South was desegregated quietly in a way that made it work. It wasn't imposed on the South, but by persuasion, a little bit of extra persuasion at various meetings when the President of the United States had a huge impact. Or with the trade unions that were very segregated. Quotas in the Nixon administration to make sure the trade unions got integrated and had minority workers in them. When President Nixon had retired in 1985, the Waldorf Astoria, full of African-American people who were successful businessmen who ascribed their success to his bridges to human dignity and black capitalism, and they thanked him for it. Now, those are the traditions of the Republican Party. Are the traditions that we are working in New York State to further in many, many different ways.
Do you think we can get back there with Trump as the head of the ticket?
We have to keep doing it. We have to be the party of the big tent, the party that is welcoming not just African-Americans or inner-city people, but Hispanics of all sorts. And Hispanics are a very diverse group. just the way people of color are a very diverse group. And we are in different ways, like that's politics appealing to different groups in different ways among minorities. For instance, Jamaicans. There's a party, the Party of Ciega, long back when we have relationships with them. They have come up and said, we'll help you organize Jamaicans in New York City if you will help us with our elections in Jamaica. These are the kinds of connections that we can make in the great city of New York in order to succeed in reaching out to minorities, having them part of what we're doing, and particularly, absolutely important, winning the mayoralty in New York next year.
Yeah, you offered a bit of a preview of your game plan for that. We're straying all over the place here. It's very interesting. I just wanted to go back.
It was a good question that required a complicated
answer. No, I know. I wanted to get back to 1968 for a moment on a personal note. I'm just slightly younger than you, Ed, and I was just sort of coming of age then. And, you know, that was the year Martin Luther King was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. You had a president elected who, you know, was polarizing. And I'm wondering, it just kind of, you know, when we had the conventions and the riots, it just, to me, it feels a little bit like 1968 right now. And you know, what do you think of that from being in the middle of all that? You were on a different side of it. I was just a child watching it on TV. You were living it.
The nation was polarized. It's not that the president was polarizing. The nation was polarized. And you obviously have to appeal to your supporters, but in the end...
And are you seeing that now with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as well? They're you know, either the nation's polarized or they're polarizing figures.
As I said before, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And this is a softer rhyme than back then, as those who experienced 68. I mean, he came in as president, 300 draftees a week were dying in Vietnam, a problem left over to him by President Johnson. I mean, this was a very, very rough time. Yeah. It was huge. And the civil rights, the aftermath of the civil rights, and the legislation that was passed, and all of those issues. And in the end, the theme was bring us together. And President Nixon talked about a girl who held up a sign, bring us together. And he adopted that as his slogan. So
that was his acceptance speech, wasn't it?
That was his acceptance. And that was a very important theme, because that was important for the country. That's what acceptance speeches are about. It's about winning, but also about how you will govern. And I think we're going to see an extraordinary acceptance speech from Donald Trump.
Okay, good point.
Very important.
And this will be our last question. What are you expecting to hear from native son Donald Trump in his acceptance speech on Thursday night? What does he need to do?
I'm not privy to that.
But here's
the way it works. You run in primaries, and you start one of 17, and you find your supporters, you appeal to them. He did that very, very well. Great instincts. He's made it on his own, as opposed to Mrs. Clinton, who's riding on a name or her husband's name and coattails the whole way. So he's really secure in what he's doing. You get those votes in the primary. You become the de facto head of your party at a moment in time. You then do the things to unite your party. But then you start talking about policy. Now you folks in the media start, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? You meet with Paul Ryan. You talk about how we work together, not only to win the election, but if we were going to govern. You appoint a vice president who is a Jack Kemp, policy wonk. Policy, okay. He's ready to govern. He's selecting the right people, people who know how to govern, who have a good agenda for the country. But then you have to go to one more level. That's head of government. Our president, as opposed to Britain, where there's a queen who's the head of state, our president's also the head of state. And the head of state has to be someone who will inspire the whole country, who in a tragic situation will speak about the feelings of the country. So what you need to do in your acceptance speech, in order for people to see you as being the next president of the United States, you have to say things that make people say, oh, yes, he gets it. He can be the president of the United States. He can be the head of state.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Ed Cox, chairman of the state party. We appreciate it very much. For Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio, I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union, and that was our very first convention cast.